It seems like everywhere you look today, we appear divided. Misinformation, disinformation. These campaigns have led people into separate worlds when it comes to the science of vaccine safety.
They don't have to close their accounts down, even when the president of the United States says that their inaction is costing lives.
And the severity of the human-driven climate crisis.
Is there climate change? Yeah. Will it go back like this? I mean, will it change back? Probably. That's what I think.
While it would be nice just to ignore all of this and pretend that everyone loves the scientific method and appreciates verifiable facts, we can't really afford to do that. In the US, climate skeptics, so far, have been pretty successful at derailing large-scale efforts to focus on climate policy and push the nation away from fossil fuels. So what's the best way to break through this stalemate? Last season on Heat of the Moment, we talked with Catherine Hayhoe, a climate scientist based in a conservative part of Texas. She sees faith as an important common ground.
Beginning that conversation with what we agree on, and then connecting the dots to why climate change matters based on the values we already have, is the way to move forward with positive, constructive conversations. So the very first time I tried it out, I was pretty nervous. I'd never done this before. I mean, bringing Bible verses into a science presentation, I had no model for that. But I did it, and it totally worked.
Hayhoe's approach may be paying off. There's a small group of conservative politicians who are speaking up about the climate crisis.
Congressman Garrett Graves was named to the House's new subcommittee on the climate crisis. The Louisiana lawmaker is the ranking GOP member on the panel.
I think very clearly what's at the doorstep is the challenges that we're experiencing in regard to sea rise in some of our coastal communities.
To be fair, this isn't enough, and it isn't most conservative politicians. Their solutions also vary widely, causing some on the left to question their legitimacy.
So what's happening here is there are people who have cultural, political, religious, economic philosophies that they then invoke when they want to cherry pick one scientific result or another.
More than 30% of American adults think global warming is a natural phenomenon, according to the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. And that's despite the fact that scientists have known for decades that we are causing the Earth to warm, primarily by burning fossil fuels. What would it take for these holdout skeptics to change their minds? And does it matter if their opinions change? There aren't easy answers to these questions, but to explore them, I asked someone who actually has changed their mind and comes from a place you might not expect, the fossil fuel industry. He worked as a geologist, and he was tasked with keeping oil rigs running off the Louisiana coast.
Oh, it's exhilarating, really. I mean, here we are. Thought we were solving the nation's problems, energy problems anyway. We thought we were being patriotic. We're out there where the rubber meets the road, doing the hard work, finding the damn stuff for people to drive their cars around. And of course, it didn't occur to me that we were warming up the atmosphere and doing a lot of negative things.
That story is at the center of today's program. From Foreign Policy and the Climate Investment Funds, you're listening to Heat of the Moment, a podcast about the climate crisis and the people who are working to solve it. I'm John Sutter. Today, we feature the story of a former oil man, Alan Hubbard.
Well, when I got my degree, Virginia Tech, the main people hiring geologists were oil companies. It was that or going to teaching or some other field, but the 85% of all of us went to work for oil companies. Started work in New Orleans for about 3 or 4 years and moved to Lafayette, went to work for the oil and gas division of Dow Chemical. But I had several jobs in Lafayette.
As a geologist, one of Hubbard's main duties was looking at all the available scientific data and trying to figure out where to drill. It was difficult work, but he enjoyed it.
I made one nice discovery. Of course, you know, one well in 10 we'll find you some oil. One well in maybe 100 will actually find you a field. And I actually discovered a field called Bayou Sherman in Assumption Parish. So it's taken the well logs and seismic geophysical work and put it all together and find a reason to drill a well. And this one did really well. And we drilled about three others that did not quite as well, but it made money. It made a lot of money. And it paid me $2,000 to $3,000 a month for several years. And that was a decent living back then. It's like 40 years ago.
What did it feel like and look like to be part of that? Like, help me see kind of the expansion of the oil industry at that time.
Oh, it's exhilarating, really. I mean, here we are, thought we were solving the nation's problems, energy problems anyway. We thought we were being patriotic. We're out there where the rubber meets the road, doing the hard work, finding the damn stuff so people drive their cars around. And of course, it didn't occur to me that we were warming up the atmosphere and doing a lot of negative things. But it's just the idea that we were finding this oil and gas and helping the country, the economy grow.
Tell me more about that idea of it being patriotic. What do you mean by that?
Well, helping the economy, providing the country with something they really need. Be like being in the Army, for one, providing the defense, finding energy to keep factories going and automobiles and the hum, you know, hum of the machinery. We're keeping it going. If we quit, the oil supply would quit, and then the country would be third world or something without all the oil. We wouldn't have the things we have. And so maybe patriotic's the wrong word, but we were helping the nation, we thought.
Remind me again how long you were working in the oil industry, and then what made you decide to give it up?
I gave it up when it gave me up. In 1985, it hit a real slump. A lot of people left. A lot of people in exploration. I came up here in North Carolina, did environmental consulting and site assessments. But heck, you know, my manager at one of the companies I worked for, he ended up going out to Denver, Colorado, and driving a bakery truck. I mean, selling cars. I mean, there's all kinds of things. I like geology enough to where I'd keep my hand in it to some extent, but it was a real come down for everyone.
I mean, one surprising thing about your story is that, I mean, it sounds almost like you went from being someone who worked in the oil industry at a boom time to being someone who, I don't know if you describe yourself as a climate activist, but something close to that. And I guess I'm wondering, like, how you reflect on that transition, like what contributed to your change of heart or change of mind?
Yeah, like a lot of things, originally they say, well, we're going to warm the planet up 2 degrees in the next 100 years. I said, well, hey, price of progress, and I took that rather lightly, but realized later that's a hell of a lot. And they talked about runaway global warming. Al Gore did a lot. That if we do this long enough, we're going to have what's known as runaway global warming. It's going to perpetuate itself because there is a delay factor.
All this time, you can see what I have seen all these years. It just keeps going up. It is relentless. And now we're beginning to see the impact in the real world.
It's always probably a 30-year delay factor, and we started feeling it, and well, if there's a 30-year delay factor in implementing this, then we probably have 30 more years of global warming before it's going to level off. And when I realized that, I said, well, we got to put a lid on this. I want my grandchildren growing up in a 110-degree planet.
So what caused a shift in your thinking from someone who, you know, like you said, sort of dismissed climate science is like, you know, like this is just the price of progress, like, okay, it's going to be a little bit warmer, to someone who's alarmed by what's happening? Like, what were the moments that contributed to that change?
The fact that it's a lot more than turning up your thermostat. It's much more severe.
In the Northeast, freak flooding.
Much more moisture in the air, much more crummy weather.
Doused with up to 11 inches of rain.
Stronger hurricanes. Thunderstorms.
Meanwhile, out west, historic heat, with the region's largest fire still only 0% contained.
And this is not the climate that Homo sapiens was brought up in. We evolved in a cooler climate, just the end of the last glacial period, about 18,000 years ago. Homo sapiens came along.
So for you, though, just in your personal life, like, when did these facts start like hitting you? Was it something you saw on the news? Was it a documentary? Was it a conversation with a friend? Like, for in your personal life, what were the moments that shifted your thinking? Because I imagine that's like a big, it's a big leap, right? From like being involved in the fossil fuel industry to thinking like, oh, that you know, that is having this huge negative consequence for the state of the planet.
It was Al Gore, probably.
The assumption is something like this. The Earth is so big, we can't possibly have any lasting harmful impact on the Earth's environment.
But tell me about that.
Well, the fact that if nothing's done, it could be runaway. It could just be self-perpetuating with there's no way we can stop it. He said, if we get the Earth warmed up more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, we can live with. But if it's up to over 2 or 2.5, then we're really pretty screwed because it's probably just going to keep on warming up. And we're tipping the carbon cycle, so the new carbon cycle will have a lot more carbon than the old carbon cycle and will result in greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and just a lot more carbon that we don't need.
And livable. But the problem is this thin layer of atmosphere is being thickened by all of the global warming pollution that's being put up there. And what that does is it thickens this layer of atmosphere. More of the outgoing infrared is trapped.
And that convinced me that, you know, this is something that's going to perpetuate itself for a long time. And I keep thinking, I think my grandchildren, and they don't need to grow up with this kind of mess. They're going to be thinking, looking at us, see our gravestones, and what were they thinking when their temperature's 110 degrees? Look at this summer, for heaven's sake. Hottest July on record, period. I mean, every darn day is where we are anyway, is 90 plus. I mean, we lived in New Orleans for a while. You can expect this every single summer, 2 months of heat, maybe three. But in North Carolina, you got a cool snap once in a while. We haven't had one yet. So it's obviously getting warmer. The leaves are coming out earlier, the flowers. We didn't have, in Lincolnton, usually we have about 4 or 5 snows a year. And last 2 years, we have not had any, not one flake of snow all winter long.
You mentioned your grandkids. Like, you think about them when you think about these issues, about what's happening to the climate.
I do, yeah. It's something they're going to have to handle when their time comes. I don't have any much influence to write poison pen letters and stuff, and I really don't. I'm not in a position to make things happen. I'm not elected or anything. I'm just a citizen, and I write nasty letters to the editor every once in a while, and opinions are changing slowly. I got this editorial I wrote back in 2008. People were still thinking global warming was a hoax that they're perpetrated by liberals so they can raise your taxes. I mean, that's what people would be saying. I said, not true. It's actually happening. People are slow to, they only tell them what they want to hear. You know, can't tell them what they don't want to hear.
So it sounds like you saw an inconvenient truth, right? Like Al Gore's film. And then was it like a gradual shift in your perspective to the point where you're now alarmed about climate change and, you know, writing letters to the editor and doing things like that to try to make a difference? Or was it quick? Was it like a right away, you saw this one film and everything changed?
Well, not only see the film, but see it happening. They keep saying by the end of the century, it's going to be this way or blah, blah, blah. And really think about it now. Hell, we may be extinct by the end of the century, the way things are going.
Hmm.
I mean, it's speeded up. That's usually what happens. First slowly and then suddenly. I think Hemingway wrote something about that. Just creeps in a little bit and boom. Once it got a toehold, it takes over. I was getting vaguely aware of it, but Al Gore kind of pushed me a little harder in this direction.
Once you saw that film, was it a pretty quick shift that caused you to rethink the work that you'd been doing in the oil industry, or did it take longer for that to kind of sink in?
Well, at first I thought, well, I'm part of the solution because I'm finding oil. And then later on, after all this, I was part of the problem. I mean, instead of being part of the solution, I was part of the problem.
How did that land with you? I think it's like impressive that you have that ability to reflect on your career. I think for a lot of people that might be a pretty hard and like kind of painful thing. But how was that for you?
If I didn't do it, somebody else would have done it. I mean, that was just the prevailing thinking at the time. To me at the time, it seemed like it was something we needed to have. Now it's something we don't need as much. We have alternate renewable energy sources.
So thinking about yourself now, I mean, do you consider yourself a climate activist?
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
It means when you see something that's going to affect our climate in a negative way, you write about it.
I can relate to that. That's something I do too. And you said that you write op-eds for the local paper quite a bit?
Oh, a couple times a year, maybe.
What do you say in these op-eds?
I have one right here in front of me. I wrote this a few years ago about global warming. Global warming is real. It presents a threat to our continued existence on this planet. Years of scientific research, countless articles in scientific journals, popular magazines, and newspapers, and there are a lot more than a few people out there who can find some research that apparently contradicts global warming over the short term. They'll jump all over it, saying this indicates the whole thing is a monstrous hoax perpetrated by those liberals who want to raise our taxes. I wrote this in 08.
Do you find that it's easier to have a conversation about the climate crisis now than it was, you know, when you first started thinking about it, or closer to the time you were working in the oil industry?
Yeah, I find people receptive, but they're not. My God, we got to do something about it. I'm going to write my congressman. No, I mean, the second point I rebut, people say global warming is happening all right, but it's part of natural climate cycles, and there's no proof that humans are causing it. Better say there's no proof we aren't causing it. What we know is scary enough. What we don't know is even scarier.
When you, think about the fact that you made this pretty, I think, like remarkable transition from someone working in oil to someone who, you know, considers themselves a climate activist. Is the work that you're doing now to try to raise awareness about the climate crisis, is in some way, is that atoning for the work that you did before? Or how do you think about that transition? Like, how do you make sense of it looking back?
I guess you might say some of it's atoning, but I didn't know I was being part of the problem. I thought I was being part of the solution. If I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't be doing it. I don't know what I'd be doing because I enjoyed the work.
What would you want to say to people who either are skeptical about the science of climate change or who just don't think it's that big of a deal? You know, as someone who thought that way before and had a change of mind, a change of heart, like what would you want to say to them?
When we all start thinking it's a really big deal and we have to do something, it's maybe too late. Climate's a long-term thing and we've been messing with it now for quite a number of years, and we're going to have to pay the piper. But the longer we mess with it, the more costly that's going to become. And there is a chance that if we don't do something pretty soon, it's going to become self-perpetuating.
That was Alan Hubbard, a former oil worker and now a climate activist living in North Carolina. Our thanks to Yale Climate Connections for helping to put us in touch with Hubbard. Music. Next week on Heat of the Moment, what happens when climate change forces you to move?
Knowing what I know about reducing our global emissions, I didn't at the time see things getting better, you know, in terms of wildfires in California. And, you know, like the Midwest has been talked about as a climate refuge and places where the impacts may be much less.
That's next week on Heat of the Moment. Heat of the Moment is a partnership between Foreign Policy and the Climate Investment Funds. Our production staff includes Rosie Julin, Rob Sachs, Scott Andrews, Dan Efron, Laura Rosbrow-Tellum, Claudia Tatey, and Zimone Perez. The Climate Investment Funds is a nonpartisan champion of climate action. Political views and opinions expressed in this series do not necessarily represent those of the Climate Investment Funds, Foreign Policy, or their partners. Thanks for listening.